Oh my gosh, it's been a week. I just need a sip of water.
You did it?
Yes, we're recording. It's live. I'm so excited. Yay! Thank you for your patience.
You persevered.
Don't even know.
That's awesome. Good for you. The power of perseverance.
Yes, thank you, Jane. So welcome to Friday Night Feels, everyone. I don't know what was happening. I don't know if there was an upgrade with I don't know, technology wouldn't let me connect. So luckily I have an amazingly patient guest tonight. So I'm so excited. But welcome to Friday Night Feels. I'm licensed mental health counselor, Patrick Manette. I'm in upstate Northern New York where we've had some weird weather lately. So I'm like, I need some sunshine and rainbows. So that's for the background tonight, just to hopefully, you know, perseverance and resilience. So for those of you who are joining us for the first time, Friday Night Feels, actually, we just celebrated a year, the first year of the show, which is really exciting. And it was a show that I created, you know, when the pandemic really took over, of just a way to connect to amazing people throughout the world who are in all sorts of backgrounds and services and jobs and experiences, just to kind of connect. And it's been one of the most amazing adventures that I never anticipated. And every person I meet is incredible and wonderful. And tonight I have the amazing Jane Wessler to join us. So Jane, thank you so much for coming and thank you for your patience tonight.
Oh, my pleasure. I could empathize with you. Yes. Because you know, all of us have been under the gun at some time or other, and with technology and you have a deadline and you don't know what's going wrong, that's really difficult. And right. So I had compassion for you, but you persevered and you did it. So here we are.
Yay. So welcome to Friday Night Feels.
Yay. Thank you. So happy to be here.
Thank you. Well, I'm so glad. And Jane and I, it's so funny. So Jane was sharing with me that she's originally from New Jersey. And so I'm from Northern New York, and I was just revealing to her that I'd never been to the Jersey Shore. And she was educating me on what I've been missing. So it was, so I need to get down there. Is that what you're telling me?
Absolutely. What do we have? 127 miles of shoreline. Absolutely gorgeous. There's a different shoreline and beach. And boardwalk for every taste. I mean, from Seaside Heights and all of the games and the fun things you can do and cheesesteaks and French fries with vinegar and salt and Coors ice cream, of course, to, you know, beautiful towns like Seagirt and Spring Lake or Sandy Hook. Everybody has to go to Sandy Hook. I mean, okay. It's a national treasure. And the beautiful and historic Cape May at the tip of New Jersey. Everybody should go and visit, especially this time of year when the daffodils and the tulips are blooming and there's so much beauty there with the almost every building there is a historical a building.
Wow, that's amazing. I didn't know. I mean, I knew there was amazing stuff down there. I didn't know what I was missing.
Well, you will find out. And I guess you'll have to put that on your roster after you go and visit Jared in California.
Yes, right. I got things to do. Well, and then we'll have to have another show where we can talk about it and process that.
Absolutely.
So one of the, and I've shared this, one of the things about doing a video show and a podcast is the networking. And I always joke that it's sort of like professional dating where you're just like, okay, you know, this is a good first date. Are we going to have a second one? Like, but one of the things is when Jane and I spoke on the phone, and I'm so excited because she's going to talk about the amazing work that she's doing in the newest book that just came out in December, which is just, I can't wait to get into it. But the one thing I noticed is when we got on the phone, it felt, even though we had not really met, it felt like we had known each other forever. And it was just this easy, loving, like, go with the flow conversation. It was just, it was so exciting and natural and enjoyable. So I'm so glad you were able to join me on Friday Night Feels tonight.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I think you have something really great going here. You know, I've watched and listened to a number of your shows and, you know, I initially did it because I thought, well, I have to see what the format is like and and be prepared appropriately as a guest. Come on. That's the right thing to do. But I found myself just enjoying the vibe, and the guests to whom I listened were very interesting, and I connected with something about each of them. So that was really cool. And then Jared last week, and Jared, if you ever get a chance to watch this one, I was just so, as goofy as it might sound, proud of him. And I thought it was so important that he's speaking out, and he's really getting to do a lot of cool things. So his voice is getting out there, his story is getting out there. And I thought, for men, it's so important in our society. Men are in some ways have a handicap, you know, because men are not supposed to show their feelings. Men are supposed to be strong. And so it's hard for them to show their feelings. It's discouraged. And that's one of the things that I talk about in the book a little bit.
Right. And so let's dive into that. So the name of your book is Hurt So Good, Orgasms of Tears. Is that correct? Did I miss any?
It was one orgasm.
Oh, sorry. I just got so excited. I just added plural.
See, that's what happens when you get so excited.
It'll be for your next one. You could just use it. Be like, per Friday Night Feels, I needed to do another edition.
It's the sequel.
The first one just flowed so good that we just had to go back.
We had to do it again.
Yes. So the name is, you know, it catches your attention. Yep, beautiful cover.
Got it.
Orgasm
Hurts
of
So
Tears.
Good, an orgasm of tears.
Right. Yes. So tell me a little bit about your background. I mean, I know you and I have chatted, but I'd love people to hear your experiences and what the book is about and how it came into creation.
Sure. I'd love to tell you in the audience. So I started out as a journalist and kind of worked my way through college and university and came out the other side with a master's degree from NYU, a 66 credit 2-year degree in clinical social work. New York University has a terrific program in clinical therapeutic social work, and I became a licensed social worker after serving my time and taking all the appropriate tests and whatnot. And I did that work. I love that work, working with people. And I gravitated toward kids with emotional problems. I worked on the locked psychiatric unit at Monmouth Medical Center in Long Branch, New Jersey, with students and kids from ages 5 to their 18th birthday who had attempted suicide or homicide or both, and loved working with those guys because most of them didn't want to die. They just didn't know how to speak out. They didn't know how to get anybody's attention. And so, you know, and you know, as a therapist, when someone's in crisis, that's the time that you can really make change. Mm-hmm. And that is what we tried to do on that unit. Mm-hmm. So from there, I had some other positions as a therapist, and I decided, and I did child study team work in schools, working with kids with disabilities in an educational setting. Mm-hmm. And I really liked that too. And I decided at that point that I wanted to go back and get a doctoral degree. And I hemmed and hawed and drove my husband crazy trying to decide, do I get a PhD in psychology or do I go and get a JD, a Juris Doctorate in the law?
Ooh.
And that might sound crazy, but
no, I love it.
So that's actually what I decided to do. And with the background I have, decided to help kids with disabilities get appropriate educational services, because it so impacts their life. I mean, it's the difference between life A and life Z for kids with a disability. And there's all kinds of disabilities. Most of them you can't see with the naked eye.
Right.
So
they get dismissed.
They get dismissed, they don't get educated properly, and then guess what? They don't fulfill their lives, they don't come out, they don't get jobs and pay taxes, or they can't rise to the level of achieving good post-secondary education or becoming as independent as possible. And it's not good for them, it's not good for their parents, it's not good for society, because every parent wants their child out working, growing up, paying taxes, right? Mm-hmm. That's what we do. We grow up and we take our place in society. And so I did that for decades, and it's been great work, and I love working with the kids and the parents. It's pretty ugly, though. Litigation can be very, very ugly. Mm-hmm. And it's surprising. And we felt so strongly in my law firm. My law firm is one of the oldest law firms in New Jersey that has been doing this. We've been doing this for 44 years or something that.
And that's amazing.
Everybody in the law firm has had experience in special education. There's special ed teachers, speech and language pathologists, variety of people. And so it's been a great thing to work with them and work on behalf of children. So for a number of reasons, though, a couple of years ago, I decided to pull back from full-time mm-hmm. litigation. And I was born an author. It's something that I always wanted to do. And I worked very hard to try to write books while I was working as a litigator. But working as a litigator doesn't leave you much time.
And lots of paperwork, I would imagine.
and the crush of the demand is, mm-hmm. Unless you've been there and done it, it's almost impossible to understand. And mm-hmm. before I went to law school, I read a bunch of books about what it's like. And one famous guy said, the law is a jealous mistress, and you better be at her beck and call day and night, you know, Saturday, Sunday. If you're on vacation in Curacao, no, I got the phone glued to my ear and I'm solving a case. And if I go skiing with the family, we come back from skiing, everybody goes to bed, I'm up working on contracts and, mm-hmm. you know, writing settlement agreements. And so it consuming. Takes a lot out of you. And I wanted to do other things. And for a number of personal reasons too, I stepped back and decided it was time for me to finish my other work in life and to write a book. And in fact, it's so interesting, Patrick, how life takes you different places, mm-hmm. right? And so, and you and I know, and everybody out there who's has a professional license knows that you have to do CEUs,
yes,
continuing education credits, right, or units or whatever. So for my licensure for social work, I have to do 40 CEUs, right?
Okay.
And so I had, in the past, I had taken some courses from a man named Richard Nongard, and I got an email from him last June, I think it was, that said, write a book with Richard. And I read it and I'm like, oh, wow, this is cool. He had a 12-week program and he said, you will come out of this. You know, I will teach you everything you need to know about publishing your book. And I'm like, I'm going to do this. And so I enrolled in class and I was going to finish my first novel. I had written it, but like Stephen King, mm-hmm. I love Stephen King. Stephen King is such a literary genius, and he wrote a book about his life. It's in part autobiography and part, how to write. Cause mm-hmm. you know, he was an English teacher before he, you know, became famous as an author. And so what he does is he writes a book and he gives it to his trusted readers. So mm-hmm. I did that too. I had six people who I knew would tell me the truth mm-hmm. about the book. And so I wrote it, I had it bound. I presented it to my mom because of course you have to do that.
Right.
And so everybody read it, gave me some feedback, but I had put it aside and started the next book. And I thought when I finish the next book, I'll go back and I'll incorporate those suggestions in, and they were good suggestions. Mm-hmm. But then I was writing the second book and I had a trial, and trial just sucks your brain out, your ears. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to spend all your time doing it. You're in trial all day and then you've got to prepare for the next day of trial. And meanwhile, you have other clients. And so when you have trials, and I had several throughout those years, I didn't get to finish the second book.
Okay.
And I finally had to put it aside because the demand was just too much. And mm-hmm. I said, you know, I'm going to get back to this. Well, it was time for me to get back to it. And I intended to finish the first book and to publish it, really. Mm-hmm. But when I started the class, the momentum was so fast. I felt quite pressured and I wasn't sure I could be that creative. So what I decided to do was to write a book from my most prolific professional experience, and that was, of course, working with parents of children with special needs. So I wrote the Handbook for Parents of Children with Special Needs,
Ooh.
A Therapeutic and Legal Approach. And I did it because...
Oh my God, that's, yeah, I need this.
Oh,
well, I just have lots of clients who would benefit from this.
It's available on Amazon and Walmart, okay, and probably other stores too, but for sure, okay, there. I wrote it because, you know, as an attorney, I've done a lot of pro bono work, and we're required to do it. And, okay, and but in my law firm, we do a lot more than we're required to do. Pro bono means for the good, but it's free. It's, you do it for free. And mm-hmm. I know there are a lot of parents out there who don't have the money to hire an attorney, and it's not fair that they get run over by recalcitrant school district personnel. And I'll say, for those listening, most of the people who work in school districts are lovely, fantastic, dedicated professional people. Mm-hmm. I used to be one of them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of them. But parents need a guide. And this was the guide. I wrote this guide, and I wrote it in about 2 weeks because I had all the information here.
Right.
And so then I decided at that time, end of August, I need to write this book. I need to research to see whether this idea that I've had in my life is true. Is this really happening? So I'll explain. So all of my adult life, I have believed that there's a physiological process in the body that occurs when you have an upset and you cry emotional tears. And I think if people think about it, you know, you can recognize, I've described it as a liquid rush in my body. You know, sometimes you feel tears, they prick your eyes, it's a little painful, or your throat hurts, it kind of aches, and it actually swells, I've mm-hmm. discovered. Sometimes your abs will, you know, quiver, or your nose burns. You know, everybody, I'm sure, is a little bit different, but so there are these things that happen in the body, right? When, mm-hmm. And then the tears come out. Sometimes, sometimes we suppress them, mm-hmm. not a good thing to do. But so I felt that over time, and my husband's a psychologist, and we've had a lot of discussion about our own relationship and, you know, needs. We've read some cool books like Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus is a great book for couples, and learning about male and female needs, mm-hmm. And how we are a little bit different, big surprise. And I felt and worked it through with him that, you know, there's this parallel experience between human orgasm and human emotional tears. Mm-hmm. And so now I have the time, and now I'm going to write another book. And so I look for support for this theory, and I find it. And if you think about it, it makes total sense. Mm-hmm. So for both physical, sexual activity, orgasm, and what we call a good cry. Mm-hmm. How many times have you ever heard that? You know, oh, I had a good cry, mm-hmm. or I needed a good cry, or you need
a good release. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Or, you know, that's a good cry movie, you know, mm-hmm. the tearjerker.
Right.
With each of those physiological processes, there are four main stages. The first one is there's some kind of a trigger. There's a trigger or arousal. And if you think about it, one of them is deprivation. If you haven't had sexual activity in a while, there's a buildup. If you haven't been able to connect with somebody emotionally, there's a buildup. You go through your days, your weeks, and things happen, and you might need to just share with someone and connect to, you know, we all need to connect, right. And there are different ways to do it. So, or images can arouse the senses. Mm-hmm. Sexually, they can arouse us. If you've ever watched a video of a serviceman coming home to his family in a surprise, and you see the kids just jump on his neck, you know, and mm-hmm. hang on. I mean, that's so moving, right? Mm-hmm. So that's very powerful. And then the second stage would be tumescence. So I think it's pretty obvious what happens sexually mm-hmm. to the body, emotionally, it is amazing. Mm-hmm. So with the male in sexual activity during tumescence, there's something that closes off the bladder, right? And mm-hmm. so that the urine can't get into the semen, the seminal fluid. With emotional tears, the glottis actually closes in your throat. And that's why some people will feel that feeling of swelling and ache in the throat.
Okay.
There's a buildup.
Sorry, my...
Ow.
Sorry.
That's okay.
I'm having a technology issue. I thought someone sent me a message. Sorry, it's not shutting off.
Sorry, Mike.
Oh, sorry, Dave.
It's okay.
Continue going. Someone was just saying that your book title is very interesting.
Oh, yay! good. And I have a Facebook group if anybody wants to join too, because to me this was a thing. People need to get connected. People need to feel comfortable. People can learn how to do this. So the Facebook group is the same as the title, Hurt So Good, An Orgasm of Tears. Send me a request to join and I'll let you in. Okay, so stage three is mm-hmm. climax or crimax, where, so in climax, you have the body in a sexual release, there is emission and ejaculation. It's actually two-stage orgasm, where the body emits sperm, and then that mixes with the seminal fluid, and then it gets ejaculated. Well, similar thing happens in the body with emotional tears. The brain signals the lacrimal glands to produce tears, and they pass through the tear ducts. Sorry, produce the tears. They pass through the lacrimal glands, and something happens a little different for men than for women. Again, a parallel to, you know, sexual climax. And this is one reason why you see women crying more than men. Picture a straw and picture a gutter, right? And there's rain coming. The gutter's going to be able to carry a lot of rain down. Mm-hmm. The straw, not so much. Mm-hmm. Well, the female's duct through her nose is very small, whereas the man's is much larger and can handle a greater volume of tears, and they'll go down there instead of coming out the eye.
Oh.
But with the female, as those tears come through the lacrimal glands, it fills up and it spills over and comes down your face. You know, that's the actual climax.
Right.
And then you have the fourth stage, the fourth and final stage, which is a refractory bonding stage. And similarly to both physiological processes, the body, the brain is producing or telling the body to produce oxytocin and prolactin. And those are the feel-good chemicals. People naturally will cuddle together after, mm-hmm. soothe each other, and bond. Same thing happening. So you've got these four stages in both processes. And to me, it just brought it home for me that, yeah, this is what I thought was happening. But I didn't really have a whole, you know, idea of it. And then when I worked through it, I was mm-hmm. like, this is really cool.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I need to talk about it. And another thing that had happened for me too, Patrick, was that around that time, I had gotten some pointed negative feedback from some of my family members who, and don't get me wrong, I don't go around crying all over the place, but you know, when I'm with my family and something very serious happens, I might get teary-eyed. I might shed a tear or two.
Right.
And someone told me, to pull yourself together.
Mm.
And I said, what are you talking about? Pull myself together. What you mean you think I shouldn't cry about this? Look, and I pointed out what was happening. I said, this is the exact perfect time to shed a tear or two. I said, I don't do this at work. At work, I'm a professional person. And I don't go around the community crying all over everybody. You know, you wouldn't go around having sex all over the place or in public, or, you know, it's kind of the same thing. They're both
right.
intimate.
Right. Personal.
Yes. acts. And so, you know, it's kind of irksome to be looked at as if you're weak. And one person actually used the term hysterical.
Those are fighting words.
And, you know, it was the farthest thing from hysterical. I mean, just because you have a tear coming down your face doesn't mean you've lost control of yourself emotionally,
right.
You know, and not at all. And I faced a lot of difficulties in my life. And, you know, I don't think I've ever been hysterical, although I do recall when I was in college, Sister Mary Cordis Ritchie, one of my incredible English professors, talked about that term hysterical, and she said it means acting like a wombed creature, a person with a uterus.
Oh.
As you think about hystere, what the term hystere means, it means you have a uterus. And so I kind of poke fun at that word in my book. You know, you think about everything that women do, running Fortune 500 companies, going as an astronaut into space, you know, you name it, winning an Olympic gold medal. Mm-hmm. Lindsey Vonn was hysterical, you know, every time she won a gold medal.
Right, right.
So I also did it to validate this experience. And I learned so much. Actually, this stigma on crying, shedding an emotional tear or two, is a relatively modern thing.
You were telling me that is fascinating to me. Can we go into that a little more?
Sure. So in the 17th century, for instance, 17th century Europe, actually men cried more often than women publicly, because it was not considered an effeminate thing to do. It was actually considered a sign of strength. In literature, in Homer's The Iliad, the great hero Odysseus, he weeps profusely and he weeps frequently. Historically, if you look at warriors, Beowulf and Heike, they were great warriors, but they wept. They wept over fallen comrades. They wept over various things, and it was perfectly acceptable. It was only after, as we get to the late 17th and the early 18th century and through the Victorian era, that it became this solidified idea that crying in front of someone is weak, and only weak creatures, i.e. women, do that. And so it was acceptable for women to do that because women were thought of as these weaker, lesser creatures, which in fact we were. We didn't have the right to own property. We didn't have the right to vote, et cetera. But if you look at other times in history, people did cry. It wasn't stigmatized. It actually started when we became more industrialized. And it was thought that if people, men, cried in the workplace, they would be less productive. And so crying was banned at work.
Wow.
And so men had to learn how to turn that off and not show that side of themselves. And that has kind of carried over into today. And if you think about it, I mean, I've talked with my husband about this, and I've read stories about it, and I've watched it happen. You know, if a man shows any sign of effeminate behavior, he gets mocked. And boy, you don't want that in your, especially in your teenage years when
exactly.
your peer group is everything to you. You're going to do whatever you can to stop from crying.
Right.
And so here's an interesting thing. Have you ever seen a man go like this?
Yes. Pinching their nose.
Well, you know what they're pinching? They're pinching their tear ducts.
They
are suppressing their tears.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. There's a guy, Professor Tom Lutz, who's written a number of seminal works, no pun intended, on crying emotional tears. And he said, in one of his books, I think is where I read it, when one of his books was published, he was at like the after party or the coming out party or whatever it was. And he said he had learned that from his dad, I think, to squeeze the tears in.
Wow.
And, but he said he couldn't help it that night because he was just feeling so good and so happy. And, you know, he was overwhelmed with emotion that his book was being published. And so he did shed a tear or two. He said, I couldn't help it.
Right.
And here's this guy, even he's kind of an expert on emotional tears. And even he is affected by the stigma. I never knew that tears were studied so widely until I started looking into it. There's a guy named Ad Fingerhoots. He's from the Netherlands. He's a professor at the university there. And he did a study with some colleagues there and in South Africa of 37 countries.
Wow. And
it's so cool. They studied.
That's amazing.
They studied the patterns of crying. And he was so intrigued and enthralled with it because he said, you know, humans cry these wet, hot tears. We are the only species that does this. And, you know, there are some species that are very human-like and can communicate, can do sign language and tell us things. You know, they take care of their young. They have social groups. They help one another. And they do a lot of behavior that looks maybe what we think, maybe arrogantly, that it looks human. But no, none of them cry. None of them shed emotional tears like we do. So what's that all about?
Right. And then the shame, the guilt, the humiliation that goes along with it.
Right.
In our modern world.
Yes. And so people hide it. But actually they discovered, Ad and his colleagues discovered that, crying is pretty much the same all over, but men and women cry in different places. In some places, men are expected to cry, like at funerals, in certain areas of the world. Italian men cry the most, which maybe is not a surprise, you know, because they're, I think you get the sense.
Expressive.
Yes, exactly. So that was really interesting to read about.
Well, and one of the things that I see too working with men is, you know, that fear, that shame, their masculinity card is questioned if there's any demonstration of emotion other than sadness or anger. And if we go into any other emotion, not only is their masculinity card challenged, let's say, but then there's that humiliation, like, oh, you can't handle this. Something's wrong with you. You're
unstable. A pussy.
Yes,
you're a
exactly.
pussy. Quit
yes.
acting like a girl.
Yep. Right. There's
oh,
this
God
amazing,
forbid.
There's this amazing video. It's The Man Box, and I can't remember. It's on YouTube, so I'll have to send it to you. But it's this whole philosophy about this box of what it means to be a man.
Wow.
And so the presenter, Tony Porter, is talking about how he interviewed or talked to this young boy who said, what is it like when you're playing ball and someone says, you know, if they recommended or said something that you were being like a girl, and the little boy said, it would destroy me. So,
well, what power?
Yes. And he says, what does that mean of what we're teaching about what it means to be a female?
And a man. Exactly. Yes. Well, yeah. Right.
Well, that there's something so disgusting about this demonstration of emotion and that being female. It's, you know, it just challenges, hopefully, so many of those stereotypes. But the other thing, too, that I see is how many clients, in my experience, will apologize. And I've even done it when I've been in therapy, when I'm crying and it comes out from the depth of your soul. It's like, I'm sorry, I'm crying. I need some more tissues. and it's just insanity. It's like, where does that come from? That pain?
Human, social conditioning, I think.
Right.
It's not nature, it's nurture. And hopefully we're going to get away from that. But we certainly are entrenched. The Japanese have developed something called crying clubs where you can go. And I just thought of I was just thinking, it popped up in my head that Japan is a repressed society, but that's probably not right. It's probably not true. And it's probably not fair, but they're more polite I think they restrain themselves from a show of emotion out of respect, which we mm-hmm. could use a dose of here, right? In mm-hmm. in America, we don't necessarily respect people the way we should, especially the elderly mm-hmm. who are fonts of experience and wisdom. Mm-hmm. But so in Japan, there's less public crying, but they found out that privately, there's about the same amount of crying that goes on everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's just how much are you going to hide it, depending on what country you live in. Mm-hmm. But in Japan, you can go to a club and you can watch a tearjerker movie with other people. And so there's a kind of a camaraderie where you can go and you can get connected and you can have that release. And that release is important.
Right.
Because our body, I mean, there are reasons why we cry like that. There are three different kinds of tears. Mm-hmm. All tears are not created equal.
Right.
There are basal tears, which nourish and protect our eyes. There are reflexive tears. So if you cut open an onion or if there's smoke and it gets in your eyes, mm-hmm. then your eyes will water to get rid of that, an allergen or an irritant. Mm-hmm. And then there are emotional tears. And emotional tears occur upon some kind of emotional trigger. And if you, researchers studied each of those types of tears, mm-hmm. and they're all different. And emotional tears have a lot more protein, manganese, and prolactin. And prolactin is a natural chemical, that a hormone that actually helps us to cry. So of course it would be in that kind of a tear. There's also ACTH, ACTH, it's a stress chemical, acetocorticotropin or something like that. It occurs when our body is stressed.
Okay.
And so the body is releasing this chemical to cleanse the body. People who are depressed have a higher level of manganese than other people. I think it's 30 times the level of manganese is in those tears than in other tears.
That's fascinating.
It's pretty fascinating.
I had researched tears, so I couldn't remember that. I knew there was three kinds, but I didn't know the details of it. But it just blows my mind that it's so profound, the system in our body, that there's a chemical change with each type of tear.
And how smart and how precise and how finely tuned is this beautiful vessel that we are each given at right. birth. And, you know, we should try to take good care of it, because it sure takes good care of us. Mm-hmm. And shedding of emotional tears is one way that the body tries to bring us back to homeostasis.
Right.
And if we suppress those tears, and we do that repeatedly and chronically, we can help to create very negative things in our body, like diabetes and hypertension and various types of illnesses. I came across this fantastic quote, and I actually have a client who embodies this quote. So let me talk a little bit about what happens in the body. Mm-hmm. There's another parallel here between the sexual parallel and this emotional intimacy parallel. I'm sure you've heard the term, and pardon me if this is not appropriate, but the term blue balls. And okay. I think everybody probably knows what that means. It's a buildup, you know, it's a congestion of fluid in the body mm-hmm. when the body has had repeated sexual arousal that has gone unfulfilled. And it's painful, it hurts. Mm-hmm. Well, I coined the term blue hearts because mm-hmm. I think there's a similar buildup of emotional tension and stress in the body when, you know, we don't connect with other people. our other loved ones, our friends, and share our emotions, share our troubles when we need to do that. And that's really important. It's important to be supported. It's important to know we belong somewhere, that someone loves us, that someone needs us, that someone accepts us. And so shedding emotional tears, not only does it help to bring us back to homeostasis, mm-hmm. but it's a distress signal. Mm-hmm. It's a form of social communication. And in fact, the studies show that crying with someone and sharing that as a bonding experience, even if you're not touching, but you know, if you, so for instance, a dear beloved family member of mine lost her partner a couple of years ago. And I remember the day that he died and going to her, and she was wretched. She was mm-hmm. miserable, and she just wept and wept and wept. But of course I hugged her, but I mean, just being there and just, mm-hmm. For her to shed the tears, for me to be supportive and anytime I would need that, you know, that's an important human connection right. and bonding.
Right. And it's funny when you say that to me, it reminds me of this story when I was doing group therapy and there were all men except one woman. And they were just talking about different life issues. And it was a great conversation. But then when the woman was talking, she started to cry. And it was healthy. She was getting it out. She was feeling safe and connected. And I just looked around and none of the men said anything. And then one of them just slowly pushed the tissues over and just was like, I don't know what's going on, but if you stop crying, we'll be okay.
That was a sweet thing for him to do. And so if you read Dr. John Gray's work, he did decades of work before he ever even wrote that book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. Mm. Men feel the need, I think, you know, typically to fix mm-hmm. the problem. And I think that's very stressful for men. And what men need to understand is when a woman starts to talk and needs to cry like that, all you need to do is listen. You don't have to. Right. Let go of the stress. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, and I mean, they should talk about it because everybody's different and each problem is different too. But I think that's what happens. And I have had that experience personally. And my husband, who's a very wise, learned guy, mm-hmm. and he's a psychologist, he had to learn that. And it is not second nature for him to understand that. Because he feels that I have to fix this, mm-hmm. but they don't have to fix that. And women just need to be heard. And everybody has a different love language too. Mm-hmm. I actually heard a sermon. I went with my mother-in-law, who's an amazing woman, on April Fool's Day this year. She turned 108.
Oh, wow.
Yes, sir.
Happy birthday.
Yes. Thank you. And you know, on Mother's Day, we would often go to church with her because she mm-hmm. loved that. And we heard this amazing sermon this one year when we went with her. And this, I think they had a guest pastor, and he talked about, and you know, this can apply to anybody. You don't have to ascribe to any particular religion or any religion whatsoever. But he talked about the five love languages, and that everybody has one of those love languages. Mm-hmm. And one of them is gifts. One of them is physical touch. One of them is emotional intimacy. I forget what the other two are. I think I put that in the book, but I don't remember. But so for my husband, it was always physical touch. Like he mm-hmm. likes to be touched in any way. And for me, it's the language. I need mm-hmm. to talk. Mm-hmm. I need to talk, and I need him to listen. And you know, that's where I connect. And everybody has a need to connect with other people, unless you're an unusual person. And mm-hmm. so I have to say that too. There are some people who, you know, they don't want to connect, and that makes them, for whatever reason, uncomfortable. I should say, if hopefully I have some time left, that mm-hmm. there's something called the feedback loop. And if you are feeling isolated, and you don't have somebody to connect with, or you're reluctant to connect with someone and and even, you know, cry in front of them or share your emotions, that's going to diminish your social circle, and then you're going to have less people. And so it's this feedback loop where you're not giving feedback and you're not getting feedback, and it goes back and forth, and your social circle closes. Mm. And that is not healthy. Mm. You know,
and
lonely,
then you just feel isolated and alone and
more and more
and more traumatized than originally.
And loneliness is the new smoking, they say. And so this past year has been wicked on a lot of people, but there are ways to connect, and I would encourage people to try to do it. You know, there's a lot of Zoom groups. There are meetups there. Mm-hmm. You know, you can go on, I think it's meetup.com, mm-hmm. and look for whatever you like to do. Do you like to go for walks? Do you like to run? Do you like to cook?
Learn languages. Yep.
Learn languages, you know, knit, go out for coffee, which I
write a book.
Write a book. Oh my God. Write a book, get connected with other authors online. Yes. Learn a new skill.
Yes.
You know, and as with a Zoom group, and then you connect with people. Mm-hmm. There are ways to get connected.
And I think people sometimes, when they've been traumatized or there's mental health issues or other struggles, they think it's all or nothing. But it's really, you know, I correlate it to going to a buffet, and you take what you can take and you leave the rest.
Yes.
So you really only make the commitment that you can handle and not worry about it. You don't have to put all of your eggs in one basket.
Yes. And you don't have to let other people breach your boundaries.
Right, right. So one question that I was thinking of as you were talking about with tears, and you have mentioned it a few times about suppression. One of the questions that I get often, especially being a trauma therapist and working with couples, is when you have someone who says, I can't cry. And sometimes, you know, it's sort of, it feels as if you're hitting a wall of, if someone can't cry, there's some damage there. Like something's happened.
Well, a lot of us, maybe all of us, have limiting beliefs. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting because I'm actually studying hypnosis right now. I'm in knee deep, maybe almost waist deep in a hypnosis class that I'm doing, which is, it's incredibly fascinating to have been a therapist and to study mindfulness and all kinds of therapeutic techniques, and then to do hypnosis. Oh, and meditation. I have a meditation practice, which I learned to do as an attorney because I had to do something for my poor autonomic nervous system, which was, mm-hmm. you know, hyper aroused all the time.
All the time.
And so I'm studying hypnosis, and we're talking again about limiting beliefs and positive affirmations. And you know, they might say it a little differently. They might say, you know, when they have clients come in, they have to dehypnotize them because we mm-hmm. program ourselves mm-hmm. to believe things about what we can and cannot do. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I think we have to start there and reframe. You know, I do this to people all the time. People say something terrible about themselves, and I'm like, let's reframe that.
Right, but, right.
And it's good to let the, you know, how else might you look at that? Mm-hmm. And ask them what we call transderivational search questions, open-ended questions mm-hmm. about that, and how can they change that, and what other options are there? So if someone says, I can't, who says you can't?
Mm-hmm. Where did you learn that, right?
Oh, what are those old tapes playing in your head, mm-hmm. and whose voice is that? Mm-hmm. And is that your voice, and do you really want to tell yourself that? Mm-hmm. Or are you frightened? And if you're frightened, what are you frightened of?
Right.
And let's start here and let's go into the future. What are you successful at? Let's think about where you're successful. And then let's take that into these other areas where maybe you're struggling a little. Mm-hmm. And let's attach that success mm-hmm. and go forward into the future.
Right, right. And use the strengths that you have in other areas, and not even knowing that you can recalibrate it to these problem areas.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. And so I have a coaching business now where I help people to deal with issues that they face, including emotional intimacy, including for people who have and this is really off topic, but
it's Friday Night Feels, Jane. There's no off topic.
People have been diagnosed with osteopenia or osteoporosis, and there's a huge dairy controversy. And so I'm trying to help women and men too, but it's mostly women who get diagnosed, deal with that and realize that you don't necessarily have to take the medication, because that might not be so good either.
Wow. So it sounds like you'll have to come back.
Oh my gosh.
So we can continue talking. I mean, if you want to.
I would love to. I would love to.
That would be amazing. So just, you know, as we wind down, how can people connect with you? Is that something, you know, you mentioned Facebook group. Is there different ways that people could reach out to you?
Absolutely. You can get me through, if you're interested in this topic of emotional intimacy, I run a Facebook group for people who are working on that and interested in that. And it's called Hurt So Good, an Orgasm of Tears on Facebook. Send me a request and I'll pull you into the group. You can go to my personal website, which is janewessler.com. It's J-A-Y-N-E. That's how you spell my first name. Wessler, W-E-S-L-E-R, janewessler.com. You can send me an email at jane@janewessler.com. So those are some ways you can reach me. If you are a parent of a student with special needs, you can reach me at Jane, J-A-Y-N-E, at sgwlawfirm.com. That's Sussin, Greenwald, and Wessler, S-G-W. I'm the Wessler. Jane, J-A-Y-N-E, at sgwlawfirm.com. If you have questions about a student with special needs, I'd encourage you to get the handbook. This is a reference guide. It tells you pretty much everything to do. But if you're struggling with something, certainly you can reach out to me for that.
That's so amazing. And if anyone never needs to, they can contact me and I can connect you as well. Like sometimes people just like that loop. I just want to share before we end, if that's okay. Do you have another minute?
Absolutely. Okay. Sure.
So, you know, people are saying that they love the title, that this is a great topic. And one person, Terry, is sharing that they love the idea of the blue heart, because I believe my son suffers from that. He doesn't have that emotional support from his father. She remembers one time when he told him big boys don't cry after he got his fingers closed in the car window. My husband has never had an easy time showing his emotions. Mm-hmm. I truly believe it's his military background.
Oh,
I've learned
boy.
A lot tonight. Glad I was able to catch this one. So we were so glad you joined us, Terry.
Oh, Terry, my heart goes out to you, because, you know, your husband's not a bad guy. Your husband's a strong guy, and he's learned that that's the way to be strong. And he loves your son, and he wants him to be strong. And I hope that this can help. Maybe if you... So starting on page 91 of this book, there are ways to have a good cry and get connected and get bonded. I don't know if you've ever heard of emotional freedom tapping, but I have a video actually on my website of how to do it. And I teach you in the book to do it. And there's sort of a transcript of one of my clients who did it with her husband. And that helps you to release your emotions. And it's one way for you and your husband to start bonding, and it's something that you can talk about going forward.
Right. That's so amazing. Jane, thank you so much for coming and being with us tonight, and for having the resilience of my technological issues. And,
it was no skin off my nose. You're the one who was under the gun and had to deal with it. I thought you were fantastic.
Well, it was probably one of those moments I'm like, oh my God, she's going to regret coming on here.
No.
The work you're doing is just amazing. And I'm so glad that we're able to connect tonight.
Well, I want to thank you, Patrick. And I want to thank all of the listeners who are out there. I want to thank you for writing in about the title. Thank you. That the title just kind of hit me one day, and that's what it was. And Terry, thank you for writing in. Mm-hmm. And I know, Patrick, when you had Jared on, you said, what's one thing you want people to walk away with?
Yes.
And I thought about that, and there's different things that we could take away, but I think the universal thing is a quote that is often attributed to Plato, but that's not correct. A guy named Ian McLaren said this. He was that was actually his pen name. He was a minister of the Scottish church or something, but he said, and you may recognize it, "Be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a hard battle." Be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a hard battle. And oh, if you, I think you'll find that, learn that, have that experience over and over in our lives, all of us, that if we just take another moment when we get angry at someone, or someone cuts us off in traffic, or someone, you know, is of a different political persuasion, let's heal that going forward. I don't care whether people are Republican or Democrat or liberal or conservative. We all have things in common. We all want our children to be happy and grow up in a good world. And that's what we're all striving for. So let's remember that. So let's be kind and remember that everyone has that battle.
Thank you, Jane. That's such a beautiful way to start the weekend. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Friday Night Feels, and we'll see you in a couple weeks. Everyone have a great weekend. Bye.